Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The deeper we get into Bidenomics, the more it feels bigger than Joe Biden and broader than economics. It feels new, even for Biden, who was a wobbly liberal centrist Democrat for so many years in the Senate. The new buzzword is transformation at the FDR scale. For a shutdown economy fighting back from COVID, Biden's rescue plans are denominated in trillions here, trillions there. Total debt is running into real money. But the new doctrine is don't sweat the debt. Borrowing is almost free. Barack Obama's caution is gone. So is Bill Clinton's war on big government. When the habitat is melting, you need better government, maybe more of it. For our guest, the economic historian Adam Tooze, the key question may be whether the fever dream of Reagan tax cuts and austerity has been broken at the level of popular politics. Are we ready for a new notion of the public good and a different way to get there? Adam Tooze at Columbia, lead the way. Where do you begin?
I would begin in an era that you missed out in that wonderful conspectus. I mean, I would start in the 90s, really.
Okay.
You know, we're talking about a Democratic administration here, and there's been three in the last 30 years. And the real rupture is with the presumptions of the Clinton era. It's the break with the Democratic Party technocratic model of the 1990s. Sure, they inherited the tax-cutting culture of the 80s, and I don't think a tax cut was going to be on the cards from a Democratic administration. But if you're asking what it is they're giving up, the world that we've lost, the world we're really leaving behind is the world that Larry Summers personifies, right? It's the world of...
Yeah, talk about it.
Well, it's the world of the TV series West Wing. I mean, who did they make president in that fictional series? They made a Nobel Prize-winning economist president. That turns out not to be the 21st century, right? The 21st century turns out to be... Some of it's like WWF, World Wrestling Federation-style politics.
Yeah.
Like Donald Trump. And now with Biden, we've just got a proper professional politician, right, who blows with the wind, who knows where it's at, who can sense the mood, isn't afraid, it turns out, to spend some money if necessary, and has somehow convinced himself that the decades-long search for bipartisanship with the Republicans is a bad deal for the Democrats. So we've got ourselves a politician here. You know, I think that's a key part of the story of this year. And what that means is that literally people like Larry Summers, whose careers start in the 1990s, Janet Yellen's, by the way, also,
mm-hmm.
you know, find themselves in a very different position, whereas they used to be able to call the shots and tell us what was what. And then we were good boys and girls and we settled down and we sorted out the government accounts and balanced the budget, which was the great boast, after all, of the Clinton administration. We're not going to do that because it doesn't make sense politically. And by far and away, the most serious threat to the American Republic is the generation of politics on the right wing of the political spectrum, on the conservative side. So it's a pure politics play and essential for that reason.
Pure politics, but it reflects a lot of fundamental realities. I mean, one of the things I should have said coming in is that the Republican Party is almost, I won't say irrelevant, but they're in a different part of the stage. It's not a bipartisan negotiation anymore. What would you call it? It seems to be sort of the center of the Democratic Party working out something with the left of the Democratic Party and getting the Republicans to go out for lunch.
It's the recalcitrance of the GOP, which finally has sunk in on the Democratic side, that there is no point in chasing votes on their side, that then creates exactly the goldfish bowl negotiations on the Democratic Party side, where they just need to have every single vote. And that means that both sides of the Democratic spectrum have leverage because they need the left-wing votes and they need the centrist votes. They
right.
need Manchin and they need the squad, right? If there were some Republican votes worth bartering for, then the balance would be much more complicated. But they're boxed in or they've decided to just go with the majority they've got. And so the game is all basically between Manchin and the left.
Explain how different the Biden approach seems to be from the Obama approach. I mean, there's a lot of history in there, including COVID, but Biden comes out of Obama in a certain way. How is it getting to feel so Biden as opposed to Obama? Maybe Larry Summers is the key.
Well, I think, you know, there's a difference in personality type as well. I mean, you know, Barack Obama was, you know, a soaring rhetorician, an impressive individual, razor-sharp mind. But also, at some level, there's a kind of coldness there, a coldness which is combined with the degree of sentimentality about American society and the possibility of reconciliation and bipartisanship. And I think Biden is a man who swings with the wind and could easily get behind that agenda in 08, 09, but has learned his lessons. And the hard lesson that they learned is an inside policy wonk kind of lesson, but they didn't go big enough on the stimulus in 2009. Let's not forget, this is really about people and this is about American society. And the damage done in 08 and the incredibly protracted and slow recovery from that was a huge lost opportunity, a historic setback for many communities in the United States, notably communities of color. And they are committed to not repeating that mistake this time around, especially since 2020 was nothing if not an inequality shock. I mean, it was a lethal targeted missile against the most precarious, low-income households in the US. So it's crucial that they're not left behind in the recovery. Those of us who were well-placed last year did fabulously. Like, if you're able to keep your job and had a comfortable place to work from at home, and you had money in the stock market, you've never had it so good. Huge gains in net wealth.
I should have said, as one of the fundamental changes in the atmosphere is a kind of recognition that inequality is a disease, also that it's getting worse, and the financial system has everything to do with it. The rich getting richer. There is no incentive in the way the money is distributed to build pre-kindergartens and nutrition for babies. Do you think that's an accepted piece of the new wisdom?
I absolutely think it is. Historically, the new preoccupation with inequality starts in America. In fact, if you look back to Obama's early speeches as a young senator, he was already addressing this issue. But in the aftermath of the 2012 election, 2013, 2014, this becomes a key preoccupation for the American policymaking community and for American society at large, I think. The Occupy movement's 1% slogan really hit home, because America is a society marked by absolutely massive inequality. And yes, the policy toolkit that we're left with, if Congress logjams fiscal policy, what you're left with is central bank policy, monetary policy, that acts through financial markets. And when you stimulate the economy that way, the first people in line, as it were, to benefit are those who've got portfolios of shares. And really only the top 10% of the American wealth distribution has any significant stake in the S&P 500. But I do think the first Biden package is a pretty clean bill in terms of redistributive measures. It's targeted at the right people. It's targeted at the bottom half of the American income distribution, and much the better for that. And you're absolutely right. The jobs plan has a lot in there for the carers in American society, for childcare, for elder care, which are both crucial for middle income and lower income households, and also for workers, right? These are classically, I mean, the median care worker is a woman of color.
Let's talk about those plans, Adam Tooze, the jobs plan, as you said, but also the relief plan, the family plan, yet to be explained, really. And they all come in around $2 trillion. Sounds like an awful lot of money. And yet we keep being told that you don't ever pay these debts. You roll them over. And in the end, they're not hugely expensive and better to get the economy rolling again. Critique that rather amazing outlay of initiatives.
Well, I think they're pointed in absolutely the right direction. And I particularly like the fact there's a family plan coming down the pipe, because anyone who has attempted to raise a family knows in the United States that it's lamentably poorly provided with affordable childcare for families. So redressing that is a key issue. The scale is right. I mean, we've got to simply get used to the world that we inhabit. We have to get over our sticker shock. If the program isn't denominated in the trillions, it's not serious, really, especially because some of these programs are stretched out over many years, right? The CARES Act and the relief programs that ran through the beginning of this year, that's immediate money. That's a sugar high. But the investment program, the jobs plan, and the families program are, as they should be, longer-term investment programs which will stretch out over a period of time. Yes, this is a burden that the United States taxpayers can manage with interest rates at the levels that they currently are. What really matters is the interest payments, after all, on this debt. The debt service component of the American government budget is not rising in any kind of ominous way. And we have, in a sense, over generations, tricked ourselves by looking at the wrong number. I mean, what you're interested in is the interest payments. So, no, these are debts that we can cope with. It's no cause for panic. And that debt rhetoric really needs to be consistently examined. When anyone comes to you with that kind of argument, you have to ask about their motives. And you have, crucially, to ask what it is they're proposing to cut first, because that will quite often tell you a lot about their perspective and where they're coming from and what their actual priorities are. Because classically, it's an argument for slashing so-called entitlements.
Speak of another big shift, it seems to me, in thinking about government. Not only that it's nice to have a big government when a pandemic strikes and you need a vaccine, for example, but much broader than that, back to the fundamental Keynesian notion that the government is invariably the prime mover in the big economic developments. And in our case, the settling of the West, say, World War II, say, or the internet, say, as a gigantic changer. But so many other matters, the government has to be deeply involved in setting a new direction. Do people accept that yet, do you think?
I'm not sure I would say it's the prime mover always, but to imagine it as the problem in the way in which the famous, you know, Reagan quote, the most frightening words in the English language, "I'm from the government," that's a profoundly unhelpful way of thinking about it. Yes, governments exist because we need them, right? Governments exist because they provide essential infrastructure. They exist because we need a common civilization that can only be organized collectively. And so, yes, absolutely, their fingerprints, their involvement is evident everywhere in the level of education that we enjoy collectively, in yep. science and technology that smart, well-educated people produce, out of the labs from which so many of the key innovations of the 20th and 21st century originated. Yes, of course, the government's place is there and has provided a really active and effective support. We see it most recently in the breakthroughs in renewable energy technology. Government subsidies and government support for basic research is of elemental importance. And it's interesting to see there the Biden administration invoking really America's own proud history in this respect, which goes back to the space race.
Right.
So there you're seeing a quite classic combination indeed of government involvement in the economy and in society being justified in terms of a sort of national rallying against an external enemy, one of which is climate, produced, of course, in large part by ourselves and by no group of people more than by us living in the United States. And on the other hand, an external threat in the form of the Chinese communist regime.
Coming up, the mix of money science, gambling, and vote getting in what's called Bidenomics. This is Open Source. Adam Tooze, I should have asked you to introduce yourself, how you do what you do. The last time we talked, it was about J.P. Morgan strong-arming Woodrow Wilson into World War I. You're an economist as well as historian. How do you explain yourself?
Oh, I just have an insatiable appetite for history, whether it's doing a panel this morning on the 150th anniversary of German reunification in 1871, or whether it's the affairs of the Eurozone or the United States, where I'm, you know, fortunate to live right now. I live and breathe current affairs as history, essentially, and that's a completely obsessive, preoccupying activity. And I'm not the sort of person who believes in drawing lessons from hundreds of years of history. I think we're in the modern era, and that, in a sense, is our challenge to constantly keep up and understand the radical changes that we're living through. And I think we are witnessing a break here. I mean, it's really worth our time to puzzle over and try and figure out and hand down to ourselves in 10 years' time and to new generations of people that come along the best account that we can of what just happened. That's, as it were, our mission. And to be as clear as possible in our conversation with each other and people who have the responsibility of power about what challenges they face and what to take seriously and what not.
Adam Tooze, I'd love you to go wider than we have so far. You wrote a marvelous book called Crashed about the decade between the 2008 meltdown and 2018 when you published the book. A decade of financial crises that had changed us forever. In what degree? In the personnel, in the ideas, change of ideas, are we talking about a follow-on chapter in the story of 2008?
Oh, I think we really are, and it becomes clearer by the day. In fact, I dropped what I was doing and wrote a sequel to Crashed
Yeah, explain that. I took the moral of the story to be that we're in a rapid globalization of finance, supply chains, companies, and that it's a very, very disruptive, maybe dangerous, but difficult process. And we still haven't found a way to make it work for everybody.
Absolutely. I think really you could say we've been on an accelerating arc of change, which goes back to the early 1970s, where we see the coming apart of the existing financial order and its replacement by a market-driven model of financial globalization. We see globalization, the shift to a much more multi-centered global economy, also a power system with the oil producers challenging the Soviet Union and the United States. We see unprecedented cultural turmoil within the Western states, both from the progressive side, feminists or campaigners for gay rights on the one hand, the final stages of the civil rights movement, and the conservative backlash against all of that. All of these tensions, I think, originate in that period, late 60s, early 1970s, and we are continuing to live through their consequences, including the dawning awareness of environmental threats, very much a matter of the 1970s. Think of the origins of Earth Day that we'll be celebrating soon. And what came to fruition in 2020 was the sudden convergence of those shocks long predicted, all of them immediately confronting us, especially in the United States, where we have democratic crisis, the pandemic crisis, and indeed a very threatening situation in the financial markets, as well as the escalating tension with China all at once.
What was the cue that Barack Obama missed to respond to that, not to mention Donald Trump?
I think there was a degree of conservatism, and it's very much a legacy of the Clinton era, a group of business-orientated, mainstream, establishment, progressive liberal figures converge around the Democratic Party at that moment, believe rather self-confidently that they have what it takes to direct America into the 21st century, to take advantage of the moment of unipolarity. They are the best and the brightest, no doubt, right? These are the Nobel Prize winners and the runners-up to the Nobel Prize winners. These are a brilliant group of people, as is, of course, the Biden cabinet as well. And there was a confidence that in due course, the electoral majorities would gather around the Democrats. You know, there was all of that, you know, talk about the inevitability of a more diverse, progressive, modern American society emerging that would vote for them. And of course, it has generally turned out to be true that they do win. But given America's constitutions, that does not necessarily mean that you get political power. And what they have progressively had to face up to is the fact that they were over-optimistic about the inherent stability of the economy to which they were quite deeply committed, over-optimistic about their ability to manage it, and underestimated the threat that was coming at them from the right wing, which was very deliberately, very consistently, all the way back to the era of Rush Limbaugh and Newt Gingrich, mobilizing a sustained counter-revolution itself with a history that goes back to the 1960s. If you think of somebody like William Barr, former Attorney General under Trump, you know, his career in counter-revolution started on the steps of my university now in Columbia in the late 1960s in New York, fighting, you know, the anti-Vietnam protesters. So that Obama-Clinton era group simply didn't, I think, recognize the danger of what they were dealing with. And that's the bill that we were presented with last year.
Larry Summers, by your description and my impression, sort of embodied that, shall we say, overconfident expertise. Brilliant, no question. Radical centrism, very cautious on spending. The austerity reflexes still in him. Explain or spell it out that he is the kind of representative casualty in this moment.
Summers is indeed an emblematic figure, very much trained in the 1970s and early 1980s, in the cradle, really, of American technocracy, which isn't Chicago or somewhere like that, where we normally associate neoliberalism and the market revolution with. It's on the East Coast.
MIT was his alma mater. Tenured at Harvard at 25.
And, you know, extraordinary career through the Clinton administration. And then a key economic advisor also for Obama. And exactly, embodying this very complex combination of actually a deep radicalism in his economic thinking at times. I mean, he, after all, is the author of this theory of the so-called secular stagnation. So an argument that really the American economy faces a long-run crisis. Mm. The author at the beginning of 2020 of a much read paper on the imbalances in American society created by the damage done and the undercutting of organized labor in the United States in the 70s and 80s, which so fundamentally unbalances American society and the American labor market. And yet when it comes to policy, actual policy, you know, stimulus checks or the wealth tax or the first phase of the Biden stimulus, in this very conservative position, very controlling, policing. And to me, this embodies a sort of gatekeeper function, right?
Yeah.
Gatekeeping, as it were, the boundary between true, reasonable economic policy on the one hand and irresponsible politics on the other was precisely what that generation set themselves to do. And that, I think, is why in 2021 he finds himself sidelined, because he is simply refusing to recognize, in a sense, the seriousness of the political situation. I think in his defense, he would probably say that if his forecast is correct, then the Democrats might be sailing into extremely rough political water in 2022. Because if the stimulus this year is a sugar high, then the question is what happens when we come off that sugar high. And from a political point of view, if you were a political operative, 2022 in midterm year is not the year that you want to be coming down, right, off that high. He doesn't pitch the argument in those terms, though, right? Significantly, he pitches it in terms of inflation risk. But in the back of my mind, I can't help wondering whether there isn't actually a political calculation on his part. But it's entirely typical that that's not made explicit, right? What he does is to invoke his authority as an economic mind, a great thinker of the modern American economy at this moment, to position himself. And this started before the Biden presidency began in December, when Trump temporarily blew up the final stimulus of 2020. And all of a sudden, you had Pelosi and the left swarming over the possibility of a much bigger deal. And that was the moment of the summer's went into opposition and basically said, if, you know, Hawley and Sanders agree on it, then it must be a bad idea.
But what he also says out loud is that you could borrow an awful lot more, that the deficit is not a problem. And in fact, if you borrowed to invest in careful, good, sound 10-year, 20-year investments in industry and production, it would be a wonderful idea. You could go vastly higher than 2, 4, 6 trillion.
Absolutely. And he's one of the authors of that new orthodoxy, which is basically saying the debt is not what we should be worrying about. He did this in conjunction also with Jason Furman, who teaches at Harvard, also formerly of the Obama administration.
Right.
There are not a lot of serious economic thinkers who are fundamentally worried about the debt to GDP ratio, that classic totem of the debt fixated folks. That's really gone out the window as a relevant measure and constraint on what America can do right now. What matters would be interest rates if they surged and really squeezed the debt service burden. But in other respects, the fundamental disagreement is over what the money is being spent on and whether it makes sense to prioritize providing aid to people, which is what that first Biden stimulus was all about. It was about demonstrating the government is there for you promptly and quickly. And we recognize the trauma that you went through in 2020, and we're determined to do something about it.
Back to these big $2 trillion plans, thinking infrastructure specifically. It sounds to me an awful lot like the Green New Deal. They don't call it that, but it's aimed at rebuilding the energy grid and building up a whole new category of jobs. Can you give us the short history of Green New Deal politics in your native UK, but also here? What's going on? It didn't do well in the congressional races last year, but it still seems to be front and center on the Washington agenda.
The first people to tout a Green New Deal were the Obama administration. And they came to grief over the push to get a cap and trade system. In other words, you know, limiting emissions through making a market in tradable certificates for emissions. And that failed. And it was the second time that a carbon pricing type model had failed. It failed under Clinton as well. And so the climate left in the United States became increasingly agitated, wanting to push urgently for action, decided to focus on investment and on spending instead. And that's when the New Deal associations came in. It linked together a social justice agenda, a racial justice agenda indeed, and really coming out of the midterms of 2018, began to push hard for this expansive agenda of spending on welfare, on the reconstruction of American society, coupled together with climate. So the idea is that you can build a broadly based coalition, a progressive coalition around environmental politics. And in a sense, for me, the irony of 2020 is that on both sides of the Atlantic, in Britain at the end of 2019, and then in the runoffs for the Democratic Party nomination, the leading advocates of the Green New Deal program, so Jeremy Corbyn in the UK and Bernie Sanders in the US, were defeated. But their diagnosis that our modern societies face, a combined ecological crisis, social crisis, and economic crisis linked to the dysfunctions of capitalism and in particular its financial wing is so on point that in a sense it can't be denied. And so de facto, it became the organizing idea of the Biden, already the Biden campaign. When Sanders folded, one of the things that happened is that the advisory teams around Sanders moved into essentially open coalition talks with the Biden team. And so, yes, large parts of that agenda are now informing the Biden administration, though it would be bad politics to openly acknowledge this. And it's because it's good politics for the Democratic administration. It's also simply the most comprehensive and effective analysis of our situation that the left certainly has to offer.
So many things about the Biden approach that you're praising. I wonder, do you see transformation in the sum total of all of it? And if not, why not?
Well, I think we have to wait and see. And certainly in terms of the aspirations of this administration and the way in which it's going about launching these programs, it's transformative. Whether or not it's enough to change American society and the profoundly entrenched inequalities and divisions within American society, that we do not know. As the agenda of a Democratic administration, it's unlike anything we've seen. One would have to go back probably to Johnson, I think, to see anything on a similar sort of scale. And it's hugely welcome and to that extent, you know, deserves the praise. American society is a tough nut to crack. And it's not obvious to me that it can quite do that job simply because the scale of the problems is so immense. And the time, especially on climate, is so short. The bit which is most conservative are the assumptions about America's place in the world that it embodies. And that's where I see least change, to be absolutely honest. That's the area where I think, as it were, the Biden administration, and I'm thinking more of the State Department team, but also Kerry on climate, have the most sort of adjusting to reality still to do, because there is there a more or less explicit reference back to the age of unipolar American dominance.
Right.
And those times are gone. That's over.
Who's going to explain that to them?
Well, I think it'll come through, you know, reality checks. I'm very interested about this big climate summit that the administration is planning to host at the end of April, because the ask there to be in the climate bidding war right now, you have to make a credible commitment to a 50% cut in emissions by 2030. That's just to get onto the table, right? That's the minimum bid. That's a really tough ask for the administration, and it's not obvious how the different components, praiseworthy though they may be, add up to a set of policies that will credibly deliver that kind of goal, because the Biden administration isn't using carbon targeting, it's carbon pricing, it's not using a cap and trade system. So it's gambling on investment essentially as the driver of transformation and regulation. And those might work, but really it is indeed uncertain.
Back to this matter of transformation. Transformation is the wrong word. If you asked almost anybody, do you want this country transformed? People would reach for their gun. But at the same time, there's an underlying dread out there. I think that we're in a decline mode as far as we can see. But the political dread out there that I feel is that we've been captured by the finance industries, not only by the rich, but by political finance, Wall Street. And I'm a little surprised that nobody is saying that as clearly as Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders did.
That's the divide between the Biden camp and the Warren and Sanders types, right? The Biden team has absorbed very little of the hard-edged class politics, which somebody like Sanders brings to the table quite explicitly. Where I think it's going to get interesting is in the regulatory sphere. And though they aren't pushing a rhetoric of class, they are speaking about inequality, which, of course, is not quite the same thing, because class implies a degree of antagonism and who did what to whom, whereas inequality doesn't seem as though anyone could really be against that. But where I think we are going to see the rubber hit the road is on regulatory issues, and they have appointed a team of regulators. And it's not just finance. It's also, crucially, big tech, where I think we could see some real action. And these are people who are taking seriously the stories about oligopoly that have come very much to the fore in the same period with our increasing preoccupation with inequality. And I think, though it may not, as it were, trumpet this out, the administration could be transformative in those domains as well. But those are fights that will have to be waged in the long protracted attritional struggle, shifting key regulations on those issues and pursuing the sort of hard antitrust cases against the big tech firms I think that's where we might see some real action here. And that's untested. We don't know what that politics looks like and how the coalition around Biden is really put together yet on those issues.
Big picture, Adam Tooze, and it's complex. What definition of victory would you suggest for President Biden? And I wonder what's your own way out of all these troubles?
The absolute precondition for a positive story from America going forward is that they do not lose control of Congress in a midterm disaster like in 2010 or 1994. That's the sine qua non. Without that, nothing good gets done. We know the GOP will dig in, and we know the GOP is not getting healthier, right? The prevalence of, frankly, crazy ideas about what happened last year in the GOP. I mean, the majority of self-identified Republicans believe the election was stolen. So the Constitution is not safe in their hands. The political system is not safe in their hands. And so success for the Biden administration consists in winning politically and securing political dominance. And the good news is that that is fully consistent with constructive economic policymaking. You know, it'd be hard if there was really a kind of conflict there and some kind of trade-off, but there isn't. I think what they're gambling is if they govern effectively and they deliver, then they will be rewarded politically. And that seems to me the right way to go. We are in a situation of extreme risks, and this does involve risks, but that, to my mind, is the right gamble to be making.
Sum it up, the gamble.
The gamble is go big and win at the polls in 2022. And that's the strategy, right? That going small, being conservative, has not paid off in the past. That the least responsible thing to do right now would be to follow old-fashioned prescriptions of responsibility on fiscal policy, because that ends up handing the political game to an opponent that, judged from the liberal side, obviously all of this is a matter of perspective, but judged from the liberal side, is simply dangerous to American democracy.
Coming up, second-guessing the news coverage and a last word from Adam Tooze. This is Open Source. Stephen Perlstein of The Washington Post was credited with masterful clarity when he won a Pulitzer Prize for commentary on the 08 meltdown. When he quit his Post column this spring, Steve said he felt mainstream economics coverage in 2021 is tilted by free lunch fantasy, as if the Biden remedies were risk-free. I asked him this week to correct the picture we're getting.
There seems to now be a very fashionable feeling, particularly in the Democratic progressive side, that debt doesn't matter at all. Inflation doesn't matter. Debt doesn't matter. We can take on as much as we want. The government can borrow as much as we want, spend as much as we want. The Federal Reserve can print as much as we want. The only thing that's important is to keep maximum employment, keep maximum number of people in the workforce, and then a maximum number of those people employed, keep the economy running hot. That will end the inequality problem, because it'll give labor some leverage in its negotiations with employers. That will raise wages and solve the inequality problem. And that's all we need to worry about. And everything else is detail. Everything else is, you know, conservative or Wall Street propaganda to have you worry about something that's less important. And there's no reason why we can't borrow and spend and print indefinitely.
Sounds awfully nice. I mean, what's wrong with the theory? Where does it break down, in your view?
Well, the sort of law of physics haven't been repealed, and neither the law of economics. You really can't borrow and spend and print your way to prosperity over the long run. At some point, you'll owe a lot of money to people. At some point, people won't take your currency. They won't take your debt. And when they do, the annual interest payments will skyrocket and you'll be bankrupt, or other people will own your country. How far can we go? Well, the United States can go a lot farther than most other countries, probably farther than any other country. Our currency is the global currency, and our debt is the benchmark against which all other debt is pegged. It's also debt which a lot of different actors in the global economy and finance want to hold.
Right.
All those things give us a great advantage, so that we can take on more debt, we can print more debt, and we probably can print more money. But how much more, we don't know. We're in new territory now. We're beyond anything we once thought possible. And we don't know at what point you get to the tipping point where people stop wanting to lend to you, not wanting to hold your currency. And at that point, when it does start to unwind, it will be painful and it will be dramatic and fast. And so the idea that we don't see it on the horizon, therefore it's not to worry about, well, that's just false.
Steve Perlstein, speak to the suspicion we all have that this printing of money, inflating the stock market, inflating ultra-luxury summer housing, for example, is a big contributor by now to the inequality that we suffer from, scandalously.
For a while, liberals were cheerleading the Federal Reserve as it was printing, you know, $1 trillion after another trillion after another trillion. And this was under the theory that if you run the economy hot, that demand for labor will go up, therefore wages will go up, and we will solve the inequality problem. There is something to the effect that if you run the economy hotter, workers will have more leverage. But if you're worried about inequality, for the last, certainly since the financial crisis, the biggest driver of inequality of income and wealth has been the fact that the people who own financial assets, stocks, bonds, real estate, fine art, that those things have gone up in value so fast that that is where both their wealth and their income has been coming from. And the reason that's so is that these assets are purchased with borrowed money by the big players. And the cheaper the money is, the more that the trading value of those things goes up, even if nothing else changes. If a company doesn't get any more profitable, that the only thing that happens in the world is that the cost of borrowing goes down, then that stock is worth more because I can borrow so much more cheaply that I can buy so much more of it if I'm a hedge fund or I'm a pension fund. And because I can borrow so much more of it, the demand for it goes up without the supply changing. Therefore, the price will go up. It's mechanical. It's arithmetic. And so the greatest source of wealth inequality, and with that income inequality, particularly at the top, has been the fact that we've had huge inflation of one sort. Inflation in the value of financial assets, which is directly attributable to cheap and plentiful money.
And yet we've been through several cycles of it by now.
Yes. This started, for those of us who've been around a while, this started with the S&L crisis of the late 1980s. And then we went on to the Asian financial crisis of the late 1990s. And then we went on to the tech and telecom bubble of the early 2000s. And then we went to the 2008 financial crisis. Most of these were debt-driven, that is, cheap debt-driven bubbles, and then they burst. And here's the other problem with having this sort of boom and bust cycle. The innocent victims of these things are not the people who invested badly, because they tend to be rich people who, in the end of the day, come out all right. The people who suffer are ordinary workers who had nothing to do with this, but because the bubble bursts and it causes a recession, those people, for no fault of their own, lose their job, lose their income. Maybe some people lose their businesses, and they're the ones who suffer from it.
Lose their houses, right?
Well, they lose their houses because they lose their income, yes.
Steve, what are the alternative policies that we're not hearing about?
So one of the things that happened in the early phases of this recession in particular is that the Congress, because of political polarization and division, there was a fear that Congress wouldn't move aggressively to provide fiscal stimulus or enough of it. So the Federal Reserve very quickly stepped in and basically said, we're going to print $2-3 trillion and are continuing to print more than $1.5 trillion a year on a monthly increment of new money, pushing it into the financial system, lowering the cost of money and making it more available. Well, with the Democratic Congress and the Democratic president stepping up and proposing to spend really big money here to do not just so much fiscal stimulus, but investment in public goods, to provide money to people who suddenly don't have it. All good policies, by the way. Now is it time for the Federal Reserve to start backing off. And here, to me, Chris, is the one thing that people don't have their eye on, which is they should be pulling back now. They should be saying, okay, instead of printing, you know, $120 billion a month, we're going to cut back to 80. And then maybe in the 3 months, we're going to cut back to 60 and then maybe to 40. That's what they should be saying. But they're not saying it. And the reason they're not saying it, because they know the moment that they announce that, the stock market will be down 20%.
Wow.
And that real estate will be down. Real estate is down for other reasons, but will also start to crash. And the reason is because investors know that the prices that we have now, which are at record level relative to whatever you want to say it's relative to, is based on the fact that this is continuing. And as soon as they stop, the air will come out of that bubble. So now comes a new crisis and they do it all over again. Now they're printing and they're buying bonds and they're adding to their balance sheet. And each time we just ratchet up without ever going down, we got to stop printing this money because we're now addicted to it. Our economy is thoroughly addicted to this monetary stimulus. And anytime anyone says we're going to just stop doing it, not even unwind it, they know the markets will go crazy as they did one time when Bernanke hinted that he might do it. And the market had such a temper tantrum that he said a few days later, oh, never mind.
Steve, as you speak, I'm hearing the voice of somebody trying to get addicts off a suicidal high.
The analogy is perfect, Chris. It is an addiction and it is going to be painful to withdraw. I wouldn't try to sugarcoat it. There will be an effect. But let me ask you, who is primarily going to be hurt by the fact that there's a 20% correction in the stock market that is already at record levels? Well, it's not going to be Joe working class. It's the class that has done extremely well during this period of time. And they know the value of these things is inflated. Do you really think that the actual economic value of housing in East Hampton has doubled in the last 2 years? I don't think so. I mean, the world hasn't changed that much. The only thing that's changed is the financial situation.
Mm-hmm. Steve, you've covered a lot of ground, but anything more you want to say about the Adam Tooze picture?
One thing I noted when I was listening to what Adam Tooze said was that everything's going to be fine because it's not the level of debt, the amount of outstanding debt you have, it's the interest payments on that debt that matter. And there's something to that. It's not the whole story, but it is a big part of the story. So let's assume that instead of the prevailing interest rate that the government pays going from 1.8%, which is what is expected to do very slowly over the decade, what if it goes up to 2.7, which, by the way, would be low by historic standards? Well, if it goes up to 2.7, all of a sudden, we're paying $1 trillion a year. And so our interest payments on debt would go from the current 300 to $1 trillion. That's $700 billion every year. That's a lot of money. That's 3% of GDP. And so to sort of say, well, as long as that doesn't happen, we'll be fine. Well, you don't know that that's not going to happen. And that could very well happen. Number one, there could be inflation because of all this spending. And inflation means higher interest rates because lenders will demand that. I don't disagree that we need to go big at this moment on a lot of public investments because we've been not making them for so long. But going big means going big over 10 years, over 20 years, and it means doing it well. And it maybe means maybe spending less on some other things. And you got to do all those things at once without thinking that all this is easy. We don't have to give up. Most of us don't have to give up anything. We don't have to pay any more taxes. We're getting a free lunch. You know, life isn't like that. I think we all understand that. It is trade-offs. These don't have to be hugely painful trade-offs, but let's not put out the fiction that there's no downside and only upside, which unfortunately is what a lot of what I read in the mainstream media today, and it's what I'm hearing from so-called progressive advocates today.
Steve Prostein, thank you. I begin to understand why you were cited for masterful clarity in the Pulitzer Prize. Thanks.
You're welcome.
So, back to our historian of the present, Adam Tooze at Columbia. Adam Tooze, striking to me how many pieces of this three-ring circus you're watching in detail. Is there a wise center? It seems to me the key guy in this strange moment might just be Joe Biden, and we're still getting to know the virtues of a guy who sniffs the wind and shakes every hand, looks in every eye to find out something.
And the counterpart to him is Jerome Powell, you know, like, who also is like a complete surprise. I mean, who'd have thought it, right? Because you would have said Jerome Powell and Joe Biden are cut from very much the same cloth. You know, in Powell's case, glad-handing business lawyer. He's absolutely not a Yellen or a Bernanke, super wonk. And he's not a street-smart Wall Street ideologue like Greenspan was. And he's not some sort of tough guy, Paul Volcker. He's this very urbane sort of player, but by every account that I've read and spoken to people, incredibly broad-minded pal. He just soaks things up and in a kind of empirical way has just looked at the situation. He has a sort of social heart. He's a philanthropic attitude to American society. I think he's personally very wealthy, but like, you know, he actually, I think, genuinely cares for ordinary Americans and was profoundly alarmed by the unemployment numbers that were coming out last year. He will go down in history as a transformative Fed chair. It's just not what anyone anticipated. You know, it's kind of like the last ride of the baby boomers somehow.
Yeah. I would still say, partly from reading you, that it's all still about swallowing a global consciousness, a global economy, a global society, a global definition of who we all are.
And I think in that respect, specifically, America has some distance yet to travel, because one of the things that I think that 2020 and Trump did, after all, was turn all our gazes inwards. And the entire world was staring at America because it was a horror show for huge numbers of people around the world. And you know, the extraordinary drama between November and the final moment at which Biden takes office is like nothing I've ever experienced. And I know it's true of my friends in Europe and the UK as well, that they were all just staring in horror. And finding the space, finding the normality, and this is, I think, what the Biden administration is trying to give us, to be able to turn our gaze back to the scale of the global and the transformations going on around us, that is absolutely the challenge. Climate is one of the avenues to which you can do that. And I think that's one of the more positive avenues. As I say, I really seriously worry about the direction of American policy towards China, because when the American president says China wants to be number one, it's not going to happen on my watch. This is a profoundly unconstructive way of figuring America's relationship to the world, of which China happens to be, like it or not, a larger part.
Adam, what's the most important question I didn't ask you about where the hell we are?
As a historian, of course, what fascinates me is the kaleidoscope of historical references we've got going. And we've got the New Deal going, and we've got World War II, and that's, as it were, in some senses, sort of a warm, cuddly place to go from the point of view of liberals and Democrats anyway. And then Biden is, you know, powerfully playing the Sputnik space race 50s, 60s moment when he was a teenager. It's worth remarking. Where I feel we need to get to is the much more complex terrain of the 70s and détente, really. And that, when you say quite rightly that the challenge is to somehow grasp the world, that's the moment when that problem appeared on the horizon. And you, being of your generation, you will feel the force of, I hope, of what I'm saying. And that I think is still the outstanding challenge. And we still really don't know quite how to do that.
How to replay the Cold War with Russia with a happier record this time with China.
Well, when we played the Cold War with the Soviet Union the last time, we had China as our ally, and it ended well for us and very badly for the Soviet Union. And the question, of course, is how are the roles distributed this time around, if that's exactly where we're headed back to? And as a European, you know, the lesson of the 1970s and the 1980s was the absolute priority of détente. What we absolutely had to do at that moment was defuse the lethal threat to humanity from the arms race and find a way of living in difference, right? Acknowledging each other's fundamental differences. And that involved dirty hands problems, right? There were no clean solutions here. This involved a degree of hypocrisy and compromise that was profoundly uncomfortable even at the time. Faced with the climate challenge and faced with the challenge of China, which is not the Soviet Union in its corrupt final stages, but something much more potent and historically significant, that, I think, is really the challenge that the American elite, the American political class, has yet to come to terms with. And there I don't see much movement in the Biden administration, rather a kind of retrogressive move back to a safe space that doesn't do justice to the situation we're in, I think.
Adam Tooze, this is wonderfully challenging, familiar, unfamiliar, exciting. Thank you.
Thank you.
Adam Tooze's forthcoming book on the COVID economic crisis is titled Shutdown. Thanks also to Stephen Perlstein, till recently the economics columnist for the Washington Post. If economics isn't difficult enough, consider James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, the most mystifying novel in history. Or go easy on yourself and listen to Finnegan and Friends, the new LitHub podcast miniseries from our producer, Adam Coleman. Let a novelist, a sleep specialist, a science journalist, and more help reveal the wake's simple wonders. Find it wherever you go for podcasts or at lithub.com. You can find lots more open source podcasts and conversations at radioopensource.org. And while you're there, think of leaving something in the tip jar for the hardest working team in radio. That's Adam Coleman and George Hicks, with engineering help from Chris Johnson and Michael Garth. Mary McGrath keeps trying to teach us McGrathonomics. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.